Welcome to Patients at Risk, a discussion of the dangers that patients face when physicians are replaced with non-physician practitioners. I'm Dr. Rebecca Bernard, and I'm joined by my co-host and the co-author of our book, Patients at Risk, The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assistant in Healthcare, Dr. Naran Al-Ajba.
Good evening.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know that in this episode, we will be discussing topics that some may find disturbing, including discussion of suicide. If you are having any mental health concerns or thoughts of self-harm, help is available. Please contact your physician or call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline for assistance.
In our last episode, we discussed allegations of sexual misconduct brought by the Board of Nursing against Gerald J. Baltz, a psychiatric nurse practitioner who was found to have had a sexual relationship with a patient under his care, who subsequently took her own life. The report was initiated in April of 2018, and an official case was filed in June 15th of 2020. But a search of the Board of Nursing, as of the date of our recording, 6 months later, shows that Baltz continues to have an active nursing license, an active nurse practitioner license, an active nursing furnishing license, and actually something that not all people are aware of, that he is an active social worker license, and there's no complaint or any flag on his active social worker license. I don't find any history of an education or a master's in social work. And again, that's just in my research, so I could be wrong, but it does concern me that that complaint did not carry over for, say, counseling or other activities that may be related to this patient-clinician relationship. So nevertheless, 6 months later, we have all of these active licenses in California. We have an active nurse practitioner license in Washington State, which is an unsupervised state. So he's practicing with absolutely no supervision whatsoever. And he's currently offering telepsychiatry services to patients while he has this open investigation about sexual misconduct. So today we're also joined by psychiatrist Dr. Natasha Cervantes to take a closer look at the model of psychiatric nurse practitioners. Welcome, Dr. Cervantes.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
According to Gerald Baltz's profile from Insight Choices, a mental health clinic in California, he received his undergraduate degree in creative writing, but he decided to go back to school to get a bachelor's in nursing. And he says in his profile that he specifically chose nursing and not medicine because he, quote, preferred a holistic and education-based approach to care. He worked as a nurse for 1 year, then he got his master's in nursing to earn a psychiatry mental health nurse practitioner degree, and now he lists himself as specialized in adult and geriatric psychiatry. Dr. Cervantes, you are a psychiatrist. Can you tell us about your training and how it may have differed from Baltz's as a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner?
Well, all psychiatrists are physicians first. So after completing a bachelor's degree, which is a requirement for medical school, all psychiatrists complete medical school, which is 4 years. During that 4 years, it's a combination of classroom work, but also beginning of clinical work, starting in the first and second year at times. And third and fourth year is completely clinical. So by the time one finishes medical school, you can estimate you have about 5,000 hours of clinical exposure already with patient care. Psychiatrists have a 4-year program for general adult psychiatry. Now, sometimes people can do an internship in some other specialty and then do 3 full years of psychiatry in order to get that 4-year requirement. But it's always been a 4-year requirement. And that's just for general adult psychiatry. During the 4 years of psychiatry, we would get exposure to inpatient work, usually more heavily in the first and second years. Emergency room psychiatry. In my program, we had to do 2 full months of 12 hours on, 12 hours off. We would switch with somebody else to do 2 months of emergency psychiatry, 6 full months of consult psychiatry. Now, that's not the same in every program, but that's consult psychiatry refers to dealing with people with medical comorbidities or surgical issues that also have psychiatric questions that come up while they're in the hospital. You also get exposure to child psychiatry. You do 2 months, or in some programs, you can elect to do more than that. There's more specialized things that you can do in your general program, such as eating disorders, pain management, focusing on psychotic disorders specifically. And then throughout the 4 years of psychiatry training, you also have outpatient exposure. So you're expected to follow patients across the 4 years and pick up patients during those 4 years in an outpatient clinic. So you get exposure to the inpatient, the more chronically ill people, and then you have outpatient clinic patients as well. There's a lot of overnight call that happens. And usually psychiatry requires at least 6 of those initial internship months to be in internal medicine or some other medical specialty. So we do get a very strong foundation in medicine as well for that first year. A lot of psychiatrists choose to subspecialize, which requires an additional fellowship training. So as far as number of hours of training in a general program, rough estimate anywhere between 10 and 12,000 hours once a psychiatrist completes their general training. And then fellowships can be one or two additional years. And there's different fellowships. There's child psychiatry, which can be 1 or 2 years, depending on whether one chooses to do their fourth year as a focused child year and then do an additional year. There's also forensic psychiatry, which is an additional year beyond the general year. Consult psychiatry. And there's a number of other subspecialties that are emerging that create a very subspecialized education for a psychiatrist that wants to take that education a little bit further. And those fellowship years can be anywhere from, 1,000, 2,000 hours or more.
So just to recap, you have a 4-year college degree. What was your undergrad degree, may I ask?
So it was psychology for me, but it really could be in anything. So you can major in anything you want, but you do have to have a certain number of medical school prerequisites. So a lot of biology, chemistry, physics, math, there's some minimum requirements that you need, but you can major in anything. But I did choose to major in psychology, which was helpful.
Yeah.
So I already had that background.
So you had a 4-year undergraduate degree in psychology. I'm just going to compare what you did to Jay Baltz. You did 4-year undergraduate degree in psychology. He did a 4-year undergraduate degree in nursing. You then went to medical school and you did 4 years of medical school, whereas Jay went and did a master's degree in nurse practitioner. In addition to your 4 years of medical school in which you became a licensed physician, you then did a residency program in psychiatry of 4 years, is what you're telling me, with in which you received at least 12,000 clinical hours of experience.
That's about right. That's about average.
I just want to drive home the point that you went through a lot of school, a lot of education, a lot of training to do what you do, and it's why you do it so well. Then I have here to compare you to someone like Jay Baltz, who basically did a fraction of what you did. We know that nurse practitioners are required to complete 500 minimum hours of training before they're certified. So let's assume maybe Jay did more, but we know he had to do 500 hours minimum. And we also know, isn't it true, Nariam, that the school he went to for his nurse practitioner degree is offered mostly online?
Actually, what's fascinating is when you look up St. Louis University, which he calls medical school, by the way, in his bio, it's fascinating because you do get credit from your master's degree for some of those clinical hours when you go back to do your doctorate, which is what he just recently finished. And what's interesting is they sort of brag on the website that there's a 1 to 2 day, maybe it's a 2 to 3 day even orientation at the beginning of the program for the doctorate. And then you never have to show up at school again. You can completely do everything online. It's roughly like about 26 to 29 credits. And you have to come for a 1 to 2 day ending portion to your doctorate to present your Doctor of Nursing Practice project. And what I would find fascinating, if people have time to go ahead and Google the St. Louis University Doctorate of Nursing Practice program, they lay out the classes that you take, and there aren't even any specific classes that involve psychiatry, the practice of psychology, the practices of interviewing patients, the practice of generating a differential diagnosis. It's all about nursing leadership, nursing theory, and it's about somewhere in the range of 9 different courses over this time period. So what's appalling to me is 1,000 hours maximum is what we've got of experience in someone who can open up a practice, Hollywood, California, calling it Melrose Psychiatry, and get a license in Washington State with no supervision and treat patients.
Natasha, you reviewed the curriculum as well, didn't you?
Yes. And there's a couple of things I found very interesting. So first of all, it's billed as a 3-year program, which sounds really impressive until you really look at the breakdown of what those 3 years really are. It's really 2.5 years because there's no spring in the third year. And you are taking, it is 26 credit hours, I believe, total. And some of that can be transferred in, but you're taking 1 to 2, 3 credit courses per semester, which is not even, and that's considered like full-time apparently. So, I mean, we're talking about medical informatics, healthcare delivery systems, there's leadership in healthcare. And then a lot of the credits are focused on the Doctor of Nursing Practice project that they're supposed to generate. So the last 2 years, a lot of the credits are related to that. So the only thing I could find that seemed clinically related was evidence-based practice, of which there are two 3-credit hour courses that are expected. And then there is epidemiology, which again is more about learning about numbers and prevalence of things. And I'm not sure that that involves a lot of clinical practice. And I believe that is the majority of the credits.
Natasha, compare it to what you went through. Did you have courses on leadership and informatics as part of your residency? Was that a large part of your training, or how does it contrast?
That was not a large part of our training. If somebody wanted to get a course in that or do something with that, we certainly had the ability to take that as an elective. So toward the end of your fourth year, both in medical school and in residency, you usually have a few months where you can choose to do some electives, but it's really the minority of the time. It's not the majority of the time. I know in our medical school, we had the ability to take law classes or business classes as electives. And my medical school is a little bit unique in that sense, but I think a lot of schools are starting to do that. And a lot of physicians sometimes will get dual degrees while they're going through medical school. But that was not what we would consider specialization. So to get a doctorate in nursing and say that now you're like somehow better prepared clinically to treat patients, I think this curriculum will show you that it's not really... The focus is certainly not a lot of clinical care that goes on. And we don't know if there's additional face-to-face hours that are required, but you're right. I mean, this was all online. It seemed to be all online courses. And to really develop the expertise in diagnosing and learning what mental illness really looks like, you really do have to see a certain threshold volume of patients. And that's why our residencies are so long. That's why there really hasn't been a huge push to shorten these, because you can go 2 or 3 years and not see some of these rare things that we deal with. But, you know, if you're there for 3 or 4 years, you know, you might actually get exposure to some of these less common things. And then you know what it looks like, and then you know what to look for, and you know what the questions are that you need to ask, and you know how somebody's illness progresses over time. So I feel like there's really no shortcut. And even though, again, this is built as a 3-year program, this could be condensed. I mean, if a medical student were doing this curriculum, I feel like this could be condensed into 1.5 years of medical education, just based on the number of credit hours and what's expected.
Well, we know that a lot of times in these nurse practitioner programs that the students are working full time, either as nurses or if they're getting their doctorate, they're working full time as a nurse practitioner. That's certainly not something that any medical student or resident is able to carry on any other job outside of that. If anything, we're working way more hours than a typical job when we're doing that training. But what's so crazy is you've mentioned the differences and why psychiatrists are required to spend so much time training. Well, patients don't really know that. What they do know is that Jay is now calling himself a doctor online. He calls himself, advertises Dr. Jay Baltz, DNP, on his practice website. And on that practice website, he's the only prescribing practitioner listed, along with 2 licensed marriage and family therapists. So he seems to be providing care for patients, and patients may not know the difference. And in fact, I think in many cases, corporations are hiring nurse practitioners to take the role of psychiatrists. Are you seeing anything like that?
There's definitely a trend toward that. And it is, again, we've seen a lot of nurse practitioners graduating from these programs because they can graduate so quickly. So we've had this surge over the last few years of availability of nurse practitioners. And unfortunately, the combination of states allowing them this very minimum number of hours of experience in order to prescribe and essentially do a lot of what physicians have been doing. And it does seem to be diluting the quality of care. And one of the problems is that they don't know what they don't know. They may believe that they have the experience that's needed, but if you've never seen it and you don't know what to look for, you're missing things. It is problematic. And when people hear doctor, I think there's this expectation, there's this minimum amount of training that goes into it, but their training is absolutely nothing like our training.
You know, Belts, what's interesting is in his resume, he also acted as a preceptor working for Kaiser Permanente, working in precepting the geriatric physician fellows. So again, in general, a fellow, for those that are listening that aren't medical, it's an additional training program to specialize in your field. So I'm a pediatrician. My residency was 3 years. Dr. Cervantes has talked about psychiatry being 4 years. For Dr. Bernard, it's 3 years for family practice. So that's the goal of, I think, medical training, just to kind of summarize that as an example. And what's so interesting to me is by the time these geriatric fellow physicians would have been working or training in the Kaiser system, they would have had probably thousands, tens of thousands of hours more experience than Jay Baltz would have had. And yet he's training them. And it's so concerning to me how some of these corporations, like Kaiser in this particular case, and again, maybe he had a friend there. I don't want to speak for an organization. Maybe they didn't realize this, but it's appalling to me that someone who has so basically an online degree, it doesn't appear in that online degree. And this, he wasn't a doctor at that point. So when he was working for Kaiser, and overseeing these physicians who were training in the field, he was had just a master's degree in nursing from St. Louis University, which again was 100% online. And so here he is considered an expert. And what even concerns me more is that he was also hired at the same time to do fitness for duty evaluations of medical students at the request, which is what he says, at the request of the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine.
So let's break this down into two parts. Natasha is actually the fellowship director for forensics at her institution. So she's an expert on fellowships. So what do you say about a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner basically precepting or instructing fellows?
Well, I don't know if they are an ACGME fellowship, number one. That might be important because I know that for ACGME fellowships, they're accredited, the American College of Graduate Medical Education. It's really not allowed for them to be a major, for mid-levels nurse practitioners or physician assistants to be major faculty. So I would hope that he was not considered faculty. I think there's very narrow things that nurses can certainly teach residents and fellows. I mean, I know as a medical student and as a resident, you know, I would certainly, nurses taught me how to do things like start an IV or take blood or those sort of things, nursing type of things that it's nice for a medical student to know how to do. But I cannot imagine that the master's or even the doctoral training that he received prepared him to conduct supervision of geriatric fellows. I mean, there was nothing that indicated that he took anything specializing in geriatrics. And the problem is that if you do something long enough, then you can call yourself an expert, but it doesn't mean that the expertise that you're communicating is actually what a physician wants to be an expert in. So I think we need to be very careful about having somebody like that in a position where he's training physicians.
But you know, Natasha, I am seeing more and more, like in the Twitterverse, there was a recent really big explosion where a PA talked about being involved in the interview process. I think she was a neurosurgery PA. She was part of the interview process for residents that were coming in. And there was a lot of discussion, and apparently that's a thing now to have non-physician practitioners being involved in the decision-making for residents being admitted to programs, and that they are taking on a teaching type of a role in many institutions, which is to me quite concerning. Yes, there are things we can learn from each other, but to learn how to be a physician is something you should learn from another physician.
Right. I saw that, and I do share your concerns. I do think that the decisions of who gets admitted to either, a residency or a fellowship really should be made by fellow colleagues, physicians that have gone through it and know what to look for. Certainly physicians and physician assistants and nurse practitioners should collaborate, but there's always a hierarchy. Otherwise, there would be no reason for a physician to spend an additional 5 to 7 years above and beyond what a nurse practitioner spends doing their training if there's not going to be some kind of hierarchy or some kind of differential that's obvious. So yeah, that is concerning.
You know, I suspect that especially in academic centers or really any place that specialists especially get really comfortable and a little bit dependent on their physician extenders. And they become kind of like their right-hand person and they rely on them a lot to do things. And then I think they get a false sense of what that person's qualifications are, that they've trained them personally so that they know what they can do. They are very important to them. But that doesn't mean that person has the qualifications to then teach someone else. That is where, and I think we've become so PC in that these doctors are terrified to say a single word that might be construed as negative against a non-physician practitioner, even just to say, well, no, they're not the same as physicians. It's almost like there has to be this constant talking nicely, and this person is so important. They're my right hand. We couldn't do it without them. Almost to the point where the residents and the medical students are put on a lower level below the non-physician practitioners. And part of it, I guess, is because these specialists are going to work with their extenders and depend on them, whereas the residents kind of come and go. So I see where it's a little bit of for their own benefit, but it's a horrible precedent. And I really fear for our future generation of physicians.
Right. And I think we should remember that it wasn't always this way. And I feel like I, you know, when I think about it, my medical school training started 20 years ago. And I can tell you, nurse practitioners were not a thing. Physician assistants were just not a thing that we saw or that we competed with. We never had to worry about a procedure being offered to a nurse practitioner student or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant versus a resident or a student. We worried about the resident getting the procedure instead of the medical student. And then the residents worried about the fellow getting the procedure as opposed to the resident, or, you know, the third year resident was competing with the fellow and the second year resident was competing with third year resident. But this was not a thing. And medicine worked okay 20 years ago. We were doing okay. So I think we have to realize that this is a new thing, relatively speaking, and that it certainly wasn't essential for things to work well. Now, yes, is there a need for more healthcare providers in general? Yes, but there's also a way to parcel out what people can do without it being an equal thing. I don't think that a nurse practitioner should be considered equal to a resident or even a medical student. There's definitely things that they can do, and there should always be physician-led oversight of whatever they're doing. And that's difficult once you build up volumes. I think it's difficult to get a grasp on what those people are doing. And that's also on the physicians to really rein that in.
Yeah, I think that there's been so much intrusion of non-medically necessary things that doctors have to do now that we've delegated that to people. And then we've just increased their standing in our eyes because basically they're taking all this burden away from us. And so now they become very important, but it's a shame because all those, I call them non-value added intrusions, are things that are not necessary to practicing good medicine. They're things that you need to do to get paid for practicing medicine. And that's really, it's a systemic issue that's caused this, I think. So let's get into the second part of what Naran mentioned, which was a lot of people, when they read this, doctors were shocked and horrified to see that Jay Baltz has promoted himself as conducting fitness for duty evaluations of medical students. Natasha, you actually do fitness for duty evaluations. Tell us what that is.
Fitness for duty evaluation, it's usually an employer that wants to make sure that the employee is able to do whatever the essential functions of their job are. And if they can't, is this something that is permanent? Is this something that is reversible? Is this somebody that needs certain restrictions? I want to be clear that I believe that you should have the most highly trained person available to perform these evaluations. There is no shortage of psychiatrists in Los Angeles. Certainly, I don't believe that the medical school would have any difficulty in recruiting a psychiatrist to do a fitness for duty evaluation for a medical student. In fact, forensic psychiatrists who are particularly comfortable in doing these types of evaluations, there is no shortage of forensic psychiatrists in Los Angeles. And again, I don't understand why somebody would pick somebody who doesn't have any specific training in how to do these evaluations over people who do. And I'm not saying that, oh, it's because a physician can relate better to a physician and therefore we should, you know, have a physician evaluate a medical student. I don't think that's the case because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do fitness for duty on other professions. And I certainly do fitness for duty on other professions as well. But it is about incorporating a very thorough interview, collateral information, and whatever medical information is there, both on your mental status exam and in your records that fits together. And I see nowhere in a curriculum for a nurse practitioner, even at the doctorate level, something that tells you how to integrate all of that effectively and come to an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to whether somebody is fit to practice medicine. And again, I believe no shortage of individuals who are more highly qualified to do this, it's incredibly surprising to me. And I don't know whether, you know, I mean, this is his profile, you know, did he do two or did he do 20? And hopefully it wasn't very many and maybe two was enough to say fitness for duty evaluations, plural. But that's, I can't imagine why that would be a preferred specialty.
He did at least two interviews per month for 2 years, according to his resume. Mm-hmm. So again, just to clarify that one question for you, it sounds like, you know, he was working there 2012 to 2014, roughly. He says on LinkedIn, for example, in some of his other profiles that he did two at least fitness for duty evaluations per month. And to be honest with you, to me, my question is, based on what we see from SR's medical record, even after, you know, he's earning his doctorate or involved in that, you know, you mentioned sort of being really careful and doing this evaluation and documentation and differential diagnosis, et cetera. And he didn't do that already later on. So what concerns me is, number one, did he actually do proper evaluations at UCLA School of Medicine? Who was overseeing him? Because it was a supervised state. And number two, he's obviously blurred boundary lines at this point. And what concerns me is that medical students, there's a very big power differential. So I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I just am floating the question that what concerns me is when you have a power differential that large, there should be some backup or built-in protection for the student, as if these were elementary school or high school students, because in a way, med students are really vulnerable to their institutions. Can you comment on that at all?
Right. I would hope that there was some oversight with this, and perhaps he was doing more of the basic data gathering as opposed to coming to the ultimate opinion. I could see there potentially being a role for data acquisition from a nurse practitioner, but certainly not integrating, you know, the interview and the ultimate opinion and the medical records and coming to an ultimate decision independently. I find that incredibly distressing. I mean, if I were advising a student that was undergoing that type of evaluation, I would recommend that they get their own independent psychiatrist to evaluate them as well.
I think that's a really important point. And let's just take a minute to say that medical students, if you're listening, or residents, and you're going through some challenges psychologically, please get your own psychiatrist that's independent, especially if there's some troubles you're having with school. There is actually a free and confidential help line. We'll post that in the notes so that you can call and get help with a psychiatrist, and that can be confidential as well. Other institutions besides UCLA have been using nurse practitioners in this capacity. Actually, there was something similar in that they had a psychologist who had prescribing rights in Louisiana, who was actually treating medical students at Tulane University. And one of the alumni of Tulane actually took away her donation to the university because she was so upset at hearing that medical students were receiving care, prescription medications from a psychologist instead of a psychiatrist.
Right. Again, it goes back to, is this a city where there was no availability of psychiatrists? And I don't believe it was, because I think we're talking about New Orleans. And so again, you do look at factors as to what is available, but also in this day and age with the availability of telepsychiatry, it's even easier to find a psychiatrist that isn't necessarily local, but is still able to provide these types of evaluations. And these types of evaluations are doable remotely. They do take a lot of time. That's the other thing. I'm not sure how much time was spent on doing these fitness for duty evaluations, but I mean, these routinely run into the 10 to 20 hours of time by the time you're, you know, doing an in-depth interview. Usually there's some form of psychological testing that goes in with it, and usually that is sent to a psychologist or at least to somebody who can interpret it and send it back to you so you can incorporate it into your psychiatric report. But report preparation, collateral information, and record review, I mean, easily takes 10 to 20 hours.
They always use the excuse of like increasing access. You know, we hear this all the time, but like you mentioned, you know, we're talking about Southern California, we're talking about New Orleans. And then in our book, we interviewed several psychiatrists who were doing exactly what you've described, telemedicine, very successfully for underserved patients, and they were replaced by nurse practitioners that had received their training online. And so it wasn't because there weren't psychiatrists that were willing and able. It's because there's an idea of possibly saving money by replacing psychiatrists. And here there's an article from UCLA that just this year in January, UCLA received a $1.5 million grant specifically to offer online training to boost the supply of psychiatric nurse practitioners. And yet, zero residency spots were increased at UCLA's residency programs because of a lack of funding. So they're saying, well, we have this money, we're going to train psych nurse practitioners online, but there's not enough money to train psychiatrists. It's really distressing, and it makes no sense. It's a very short-sighted.
Well, I think what we'll see as one of the consequences of this is I do believe there's if there isn't already, there's probably an overdiagnosis or an over-pathologization of mental health because of poorly qualified people who might hear a few symptoms from somebody and then rush to make a diagnosis and then, you know, put them on treatment, which necessarily creates and, you know, perpetuates this need for ongoing care. I think one of the most important things that a psychiatrist can do is say, there is no pathology here, there is no illness per se, and I'm not going to start this person on medication. I do see a lot of people being given diagnoses with very questionable criteria being applied by nurse practitioners or physician assistants with, you know, and then medications being started and continued with the risk of significant side effects, expense. And then here's somebody who necessarily has to come back and is taking time that might be available for somebody who really does need it. I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that. And we'll probably in the next few years see that there's an increase in certain diagnoses all of a sudden that are probably in part due to misidentifying some of the symptoms as illnesses.
So what I'm hearing from you is that all those extra years of training that you did and all those hours that you put in, there is a good reason for them. It's so that you can properly diagnose, properly treat patients, and really help change their lives for the better. So I would say to patients, if you're listening, to ask the right questions and choose a psychiatrist for your mental health care, especially if you have a serious or more complex issue. If you'd like to learn more about this information, we encourage you to get our book, Patients at Risk, The Rise of the Nurse Practitioner and Physician Assistant in Healthcare. And if you're a physician and you'd like to learn more about getting involved, please visit our website, physiciansforpatientprotection.org. I'd like to thank so much Dr. Natasha Cervantes for joining us. It was wonderful having you, and we hope to have you back again. And my co-host, Dr. Naran Al-Ajba, thank you so much, and we'll see you at the next podcast.
Thank you so much.